This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
I'm Rhett.
And I'm Link.
And we're the hosts of the podcast Ear Biscuits. We're just two lifelong friends who've been talking about life for a long time.
From being dads to businessmen to all the random things we experience, nothing is off limits.
And now we're talking to you. We're answering your questions, giving advice that you may or may not want to take, and listening to your hilarious stories.
So leave us a voicemail to be part of the show at
1-888-EARPOD1 on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jeff Calkins is columnist of the Daily Memphian, also host of the Jeff Calkins Show 9 to 11 every single weekday right here at 92.9 FM ESPN on X, Jeff_Calkins. Jeff, how's it going, sir?
Oh, it's a beautiful day, Gabe. Beautiful.
Oh, it's phenomenal. Day. It's phenomenal out.
Phenomenal.
And it's like a nice day, calm before the storm tonight at FedEx Forum. I will say this, tonight's going to be really fun. I obviously you want the Grizzlies to win, you want a good outcome, but it really feels like the intensity's fully ratcheted back up to where we thrive, where we want it to be.
Yeah, it's certainly a big game, and late tip. So I hope folks will get out there, and the stakes. I mean, we've never had this before, really. We've never had a last week where the stakes are this high. We've had jockeying. There have been other moments where you've been trying to accomplish something in the last week, but it doesn't. I can't recall a week where it is this jumbled, this where so many different combinations are possible, and where the stakes for the Grizzlies are incredibly high. It's really not because they have to win three games, right? They have to win three games. They don't have to, but it feels like if you're going to lock in the results,
the obvious way forward.
Yeah, and it's not impossible to win three games. Now tomorrow night's really tough, given the travel and the altitude and all of that, but literally you're playing a team that just fired their coach. So it's not like, it's not like it's some juggernaut firing on all cylinders. Tonight's tough, though. Obviously, you're an underdog tonight. You're going to definitely be an underdog tomorrow. I think I saw 7.5 or something like that. So you're a substantial underdog tomorrow. And presumably you'll be favored against Dallas on Sunday.
Is there any other option with Jalen Wells out of the lineup besides sort of Vince Williams Jr. replacing him there? I know that Vince has not played well, and I guess Luke Kennard could be there if you want to supplement three-point shooting, although he hasn't played well either.
No, he hasn't played well.
But do you think there's really any other option to replace what Jalen Wells brings to that starting lineup besides Vince Williams Jr.?
No. I mean, Vince Williams Jr., evidently, I was reading Drew Hill of the Daily Memphian today, and he said that that Vince Williams invoked John Conchar. He said John Conchar is going to play tonight. It'll be interesting to see what they do. First of all, the sort of stunning thing is that when the season began, if you had told me that entering the final three games of the season, that it would be, your three stars, Zach Edey and Vince Williams as your starters, I would have said, of course that's who it will be. That makes all the sense in the world to me. That's what I would have said before the season began. I would not have imagined we would have gotten there the way we've gotten there with Marcus Smart, packed off with a first-round draft pick and Jake LaRavia discarded and Jalen Wells injured. I wouldn't have imagined all the things that would have happened to get us there. But this is, in the end, where a lot of us, I think, thought we might – be, you know, the problem is that it's not the Vince that we had hoped for. I think largely, I mean, we'll find out, I guess, over the course of his career, but largely because he's still somewhat hampered by the ankle, I think. And then once you get past him, it's, well, you know, I mean, what do you got? You got obviously Santi, who can you count on, and Scotty, who's been playing well, fundamentally, he's been playing well. But then, like, Luke Kennard has not been playing well. He's been playing, you know, you would like him to, he's got to hit shots.
Just shoot, really. Not even just hit shots. That's true. Shoot them.
Well, he also has to hit shots. But, yes, like, he's going to be a negative defensively, so you need him to be a positive on the other end. I mean, it's supposedly been a trade-off whenever you play him, and sadly, there hasn't been much of a trade-off. All you've gotten is the downside lately. Then there's, you know, there is John Conchar. There's Gigi. But I can't believe that they will. There's Lamar Stevens. There's a guy who was, you picked up on a 10-day. And honestly, might be the most sensible, you know, if you're talking about someone who brings physicality and some defense and whatnot. He hasn't played that particularly well either. But he's the guy who you might actually make more sense. Gigi, you send him down to the G League, because he was a total disaster defensively. And then since then, he's been kind of pouting, you know? I mean, he was pretty vocally pouting when I was in the locker room the other day, when he was, you know, he was pretending to smile and stuff about his situation. And so, I think it's mostly up to Vince. As Chris Harrington wrote in the Daily Memphian, the numbers on Vince when he gets rest are really fairly striking. They're much better with 3 days rest than 2 days of rest, much better with 2 days of rest than 1 day of rest. Now, he's not going to get rest between this game and the Denver game, right?
Zero rest.
Once you get to the playoffs, if they get to the playoffs, they'll certainly get to the play-in, they may get to the playoffs. There, particularly in the first round, there's much more rest actually is built in. But yeah, this will be a lot to throw on Vince, given the season that he's had.
Give me your early sort of thoughts or returns, I guess, on Tomas Asalo taking over as the interim head coach.
I've fundamentally been impressed. I think he seems totally unfazed. You know, you can imagine a situation where a coach, even a deeply experienced assistant coach who'd never been a head coach before in the NBA, would be thrown into this circumstance. This, I guess it was at least before Denver right. did what they did, this unprecedented, previously unprecedented situation, thrown in to that situation. I think you could look a little deer in the headlights. And he's not only, an assistant who's never been a head coach in the NBA before. He hadn't been in the NBA before. He's freaking Finn. He's been coaching over in Germany and France. And so for him to look as comfortable as he does and as he has looked, I think is really striking, honestly. And so that's really as much as anything. And then it's very clear, the other thing that strikes you as much as anything else is the way that he's unlocked Zach Edey, which is, you know, I mean, it's immediately put him back in the starting lineup, and we've seen the results that we've seen. He's using him as a real weapon the way that when he was drafted, one imagines that's what the Grizzlies envisioned. Now, if you look just at the numbers, and this is more Chris's department than mine, offensively they're not better, you know, but it's a tiny sample size, and defensively they are better. But they also were playing, you know, they played some – You also have to look a little bit at the opposition. So they played some, you know, at the teams they played. So I've been fundamentally impressed, but I don't think. I mean, we were talking about this in my show earlier. What matters in terms of being the full-time coach, and how much does it? What kind of coach do you want to coach Ja? I think is the
sure.
one of the massive questions going forward. And, you know, Chris Canty, who's on the show before mine, was talking about how you need a fire breather, you know, someone who can hold Ja accountable. Well, yes and no. I mean, you don't want a coach who can you want a coach who's going to get the best out of Ja, and who's going to coach Ja in a way that Ja wants to be here. Both of those things are true, right? And first of all, I don't think I think people assume because Isolo is European that he's not a coach who would quote unquote hold Ja accountable, right? I don't know that that's true. I don't think we know that enough one way or another. You clearly want a coach who can reach Ja, coach him effectively, unlock Ja, and get him to be his best self. And but I don't think we really know. I certainly don't think Chris Canty knows what that
right.
looks like. And I don't think you want someone to just come in here and lay down. If you do that to Ja,
that's not a good – I don't think – I fundamentally disagree with that thought process. I just saw that – like Michael Malone was a fire breather, and that didn't work out all that well with, at the end there with the Nuggets. I know he won a championship and all that.
Well,
But I guess that's not the main point I'm making. The point I would make is, you know, as much as you want to get outside help to quote-unquote hold Ja accountable, why can't we place that on players and Ja himself? Isn't that the whole idea of getting Ja to unlock his best self, is to hold himself accountable for the most part? Obviously, you need a kick in the ass every once in a while, but having that every single night, I don't think that would be a recipe success in the slightest for a guy like Ja Morant. I think that would be a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, all you have to do is look at, I mean, you look at how Ja has reacted to the commissioner trying to hold him accountable,
right?
And like, how is he going to react? So you don't want someone who's just going to come in, it seems to me, and say, do it this way or else, because what'll that be? The next thing you know, he'll be asking for a trade. Like, you just don't want that, right? Like, you don't want someone who's going to dare Ja to, you want someone who's going to, yes, of course, coach him hard, hold him accountable, hold the entire team accountable, but in a way that makes those players want to be accountable. You know what I mean? Not a me against you way, but a us against them way. And so I think it's tricky. But my suspicion is that if, you know, unless there's some disaster over the next three games in the postseason, and if Jaren, Ja, and Dez are bought into Isolo, then I think he will be the coach. And I think if they are not bought into Isolo, or there is some disaster, then I think he will not be the coach. But I think probably more than the W's and L's, the relationship part of it is as important over this stretch as anything else in determining who the next coach of the Grizzlies is going to be. But so far, just from what I've seen from the outside, I'm impressed.
I will preface this by saying I appreciated Taylor Jenkins' time with the Grizzlies, winning as coach in Memphis Grizzlies history, all that. Like, I thought he was a good coach while he was here. I do find it, and I know you already referenced it, I find it absolutely insane, the differences in just, what, six games with Zach Edey. Zach Edey, since Taylor Jenkins has been fired,
stunning.
Third in rebounds per game, sixth in blocks per game, fifth in screen assists per game. And, like, hearing Zach Edey talk about it, there was a quote he gave earlier in the season about, you know, everybody's just got to find their role, and my role right now is spacing the floor, cutting, doing those things. As soon as Isolo got the job, he's basically saying, yeah, I'm having success because we're running more pick and roll, where we have ball screens again. So, like, that to me has been probably the biggest story of Taylor Jenkins getting fired. And it's so insane to me that Taylor Jenkins and Noah LaRoche and that sort of regime never adjusted with Zach Edey. There were some good spike games, but they never fully went full Tomas Isolo these last six games with Zach Edey.
Well, I mean, it's very clear that it's different. If you look at screen assists, for example, the Grizzlies were, and I take this from a Chris Arrington column, I think they were easily last in the league in screen assists before this. And I think now Zach Edey is averaging as many a game, 4.8 or something roughly was the number, as the entire team was under Jenkins.
That's
right?
Gross.
And the Grizzlies number has dropped. But here's the thing. The point of an offense, and this would be the counter argument. The point of an offense is not for for Zach Edey to look good or to whatever. It's to score points.
Yes.
And if you look at the Grizzlies' offense throughout most of the year, it was top five. So who cares? This would be the counter argument. Who cares how they're doing it if it is a wildly effective offense?
Sure.
So, they didn't use Zach Edey. But you know what's happened actually since you've started? The offensive numbers have gone down. They're not as efficient offensively since Isolo has taken over.
Okay, yes, but we know numbers can lie sometimes, so let's use our eyes here too. But I think the other point, the counter-argument to your counter-argument would be, okay, yeah, Zach Edey's thriving. You don't just want one player to thrive. But when Zach Edey's thriving, who else is thriving? John Morant.
Yes, but even there, people would wonder: is the point of an offense that John Morant thrives, or that the offense?
I would say your biggest superstar ought to be thriving at a pretty high level.
I think there is. I actually come down there. I think in the end, particularly when you want, I mean, let's be honest. I think it's a happy medium here, right?
Sure.
You don't want to have an offense, even if it's an effective offense, that alienates your best player. You do, in the end, want to have an offense that incorporates some of the best qualities of players who you have. And that means, and that certainly includes Zach Edey and his best qualities, which involves screening, and John Morant, and involves his best qualities. So I think that is true, but I also think it's also fair to not just bury Taylor Jenkins for having an offense that pretty consistently over the course of his entire tenure here has been really good. And it was really less the offense than the, much like in Denver, the total collapse defensively that got him fired.
Yep. I'm with you. Now, last night, Luka returned to Dallas. That was relatively fun. I will say this, the 13 other teams in the Western Conference, and I think I speak for everybody when I say this, I'm tired of seeing Nico Harrison's stupid face up on the screen. Sick of it. Tired of it. I hold him accountable for the next 10 years, and I think everybody else will hold him accountable for the next 10 years for what he has done to tank that franchise and really hurt the rest of the Western Conference in the process.
Yeah, I think as bitter as other Western Conference fan bases can and should be, it obviously pales in comparison. I cannot imagine being a Mavs fan. I just can't imagine when your own team has betrayed you like this, right? And in a way that is going to haunt you for 10 to 15 years. I think I would have to just give up basketball for 10 to 15 years as a fan. Because it's just gutting. And I asked today if it's the worst trade in the history of the world. But not because, I mean, obviously recency bias, there are other awful trades. The Herschel Walker trade turned out badly, and Babe Ruth was sold once, and all of this, right? So there's been other worse trades. But what I think what particularly struck me about this one is, like when Babe Ruth was traded, sold, they knew what they were doing. They were selling him for money so they could stage a Broadway play. Right. Like they didn't think what we're going to do here is be better because we're getting rid of Babe Ruth. It was a different era and they wanted a Broadway play. And so whereas Nico really thought he was the smartest guy in the room, he was savvy enough to figure out that Luka wasn't going to be good because he carries some extra pounds or something, it is infuriating. The absolute smugness of the decision, right, is just crazy, because there's literally, or even if your franchise just trades a player because they're just being cheap, well, at least there, they're being cheap. It would be outrageous too. Here, the smugness of it, he really was trying to say he knows better about Luka. There's no one in the world who agrees with him. Literally anybody, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
It's craziness.
It was frustrating watching that game last night. It was fun, but it's frustrating. Let me ask you this, though. Have you ever seen a scene like that where after the game,
never,
home team has 45 dropped on them by a player, they lose running away in the fourth quarter, and they give them a damn standing ovation? That player that's playing against them. You've been around longer than
never,
me, Jeff.
I've never seen it. It's never happened. There's appreciation for a player who returns or whatever else. But what that was, it was love for Luka, but it was also, each time they did it, it was expression of total hatred and bitterness at Nico, right? And so, I don't know. Like, I don't know of a team. I just can't think of a player who wanted to be somewhere so badly, had succeeded there, was beloved there, and was then traded away.
Yep.
Like, I mean, who is there such a player who all those things?
No.
Money wasn't an issue. Like, there was nothing. There's nothing. And so I really do think every standing ovation that they gave Luka, I mean, there were probably 13 rounds of Fire Nico cheers, but every standing ovation from Luka was also that, in a sense, you know? And the problem is that that was sort of fun for one night if you're a Dallas fan and you're in there and you're cheering Luka and whatever else. But now you have to live with the consequences for 15 years. I don't think the franchise will ever get over it. The only time that you might get over it, and I'm not wishing, I certainly don't wish for Luka to blow out his knee or something, having Achilles or whatever. If Luka has some horrific injury that ruins his career, then maybe you get over it. But otherwise, even if he doesn't win a title, it doesn't matter. Like, you could have had that. Maybe if you somehow can rebuild on the fly in 5 years, and maybe, but I don't see how that's even possible. You don't just get a Luka.
Yeah.
It's hard to get a Luka.
Yeah, and the tone deaf part of this as well. I don't know if you saw the report from Tim McMahon from ESPN yesterday, but they were trying to get Luka to offer up some of his sponsors to, you know, do certain segments during the game where they could make money off of it. Of course, Luka and his team declined. I can't think of a more tone deaf ask in that situation.
Right.
Just nasty, nasty stuff. Now, final thing I want to get into, and admittedly, I have not read the article, but I have been talking about this on the show. I think we've talked about it on just about every show with the changing times in college athletics and Memphis basketball, Memphis football, where they need to go from here. John Martin wrote a really good article. Obviously, again, I haven't read it. I assume it's really good about
that question.
I'm taking it on face value. But he wrote about that question. The premise is, does Memphis as an administration have ambition for its basketball program to continue to compete nationally, or is it okay with just being the top spender in the AAC? The one question I would ask for that particular prompt is, do they have much of a choice otherwise? If they're trying to pour into football and basketball, there has to be some type of split there. And, you know, if you're splitting it in 50-50, both programs are going to suffer to a certain extent. If you split it one way or the other, one of the two programs is going to suffer. Is there really an option when you compare them to the Power Four money that we're seeing?
Well, two things. I think the story, first of all, just pointed out the reality, which is something, you know, I wrote about 2 weeks ago, how difficult this era is going to be for Memphis basketball. And I think now that we're seeing, you know, we literally saw another All-American who decided to stay I've seen different millions on top of it, and there's some have said $3 million, some have said $4 million. But if that's what PJ Haggerty's, you know, going to be asking, between $3 or $4 million, that was most of the entire budget last year. And so, there's this just broader question of how do you compete in this age? And I think that's a massive question. The second question that he brings up, and sort of towards the end of the piece, is, how do they do it with basketball and football? And I think some of the implication, I'll have to go back and read it, was that football may be being favored over basketball. And I don't know. We don't know how they're carving up the money. It's a really interesting dilemma, though, because if you would ask me what is the fundamental mistake that Memphis had made for years and years and years.
Not prioritizing football.
Is that they didn't prioritize football. And had they would have been in a better place than they are right now. Okay? So is that still true, though? In other words, is football still the ticket, or is there no ticket? In other words, if you're never going to get in, right, if you're never going to get in, is it worth prioritizing football over basketball if the ship is sailed, if football can no longer get you somewhere? Right. I'm not saying that's true or not, but it's an interesting dilemma, because the other argument, and again, I haven't figured out where I think about this. The other argument is that football can compete and be the best AA SCSE school out there. That's what they can be. But football has never actually aspired or fought, or is it realistic for them to compete for a national championship? And so shouldn't you pour your resources into the program where it is realistic to compete for a national championship? Because for God's sakes, three times you've been in the Final Four, and you just were in a, you just had a year where you're knocking off teams that went deep in the tournament, right?
Right.
And so does it make sense to do what the Big East teams are doing and whatever, you know, whatever, and prioritize basketball, because that's where you actually can compete at a national level? That would be the debate.
I'm not smart enough to figure that out, because I also think the other thing that sort of looms is the amount of revenue generated by each sport, depending on how successful you are. Football just generally generates more revenue than basketball.
No, but football also costs more. So football loses money every year, and basketball brings in money every year. That's because you have to account for all the players on scholarship who are with football. So there's a much higher tab for football. On the other hand, there's much more room for growth, it seems to me, in football, because you control your own arena, your stadium now. Like, maybe that's an opportunity where you should. Like, I can literally argue both sides of this. I suspect the answer is to try to do the best you can by both programs, right? Like, isn't that the
right
answer?
Yeah.
And so the only thing that would be interesting to me is I've heard some rumblings that football is getting more favored nation over status over basketball, but I don't know that to be true. And so I think the answer is to do the best you can by both of them. But it has been an eternal question, and Memphis has felt like they've gotten it, you know, people have said that Memphis has gotten it wrong for forever, you know, because they didn't prioritize football way back when. So I don't really envy the people who are having to decide how to do this, because here's the other problem is that when it's, you know, we saw this with the money that was either going into the Liberty Bowl or FedEx Forum. When there's a certain amount of money and it's either going to go here or here, what it tends to do is create bad feeling, right? It tends to a bitterness between those two entities. And so I suspect there's a fair amount of, you know, wrangling going on inside that athletic program, because everyone wants more and there's not enough for everybody, right?
Yep. I think that's fair. But, yeah, going out on a limb and saying they should do well by both, I think that's the only answer. But
best they can. They should do an unsatisfactory effort for both. a mediocre, the best they possibly can for both. Yeah, I don't know.
All right, well, I'm going to let you go because I hear the sirens in the background. You need to check
that
out.
Yeah, they're probably coming for me. Yeah. See ya.
All right, see you, Jeff. That is Jeff Calkins at Jeff_Calkins on X, Daily Memphian columnist, also host of the Jeff Calkins Show, 9 to 11 right here on 92.9 FM ESPN. It really is a tough, tough ask of Ed Scott early in his tenure to try to divvy up these funds. There is the thought out there that football is getting preferential treatment over basketball. We know historically that football has not gotten that preferential treatment, and people have wanted that to change. And again, you know, football has the opportunity to generate more revenue. Basketball, not so much. It's such a tough dilemma that they have. And obviously the answer ultimately would to be getting into a bigger conference, but you don't know when that ultimately will open up, when you'll have that opportunity. It is tough. It is tough to be a person making those decisions behind the scenes in the Memphis Athletic Department right now, Connor.
It is tough, but at the same time, the big discussion around the University of Memphis right now, one we've been having for the last few years, is that you want to get into a better conference, and you're going to do that with football.
Yeah, because the truth of the matter is, in the end of the day, Memphis basketball has had all this success, and it hasn't swayed the powers that be in those conferences to bring Memphis in. It's still good. I'm sure they still have their eyes on it, but I think the ultimate idea for most of these conferences is Memphis's football program going to put them over the top, so we can give them a share of the TV revenue money that we generate every year.
Right.
But I get the dilemma, because the thought right now is kind of hopelessness from the people that want to sort of spend a lot more money in basketball than they do in football. It's a little bit of hopelessness because they're saying, well, football's been on the up and up for the better part of a decade. Made a bunch of bowl games in a row. bunch of success. Been to the Cotton Bowl, won 11 games last year, been 21 and 5 the last two seasons, and that hasn't swayed the Power Four to actually dip in the Memphis bucket. So if that hasn't happened now, when's it going to happen? It's kind of a feeling of hopelessness from those people, and I don't blame them for having that. But I don't think it should stop you from continuing to try to put football probably first to get yourself to where you want to go. Yep. So there is that. We'll go ahead and grab a break. We'll come back, give you a Masters update. Quick update on the Masters. Most everybody is finishing up their rounds right now. We have guys on 17, and they're on the way in. Justin Rose still at the top, 7-under through the day. Looks like he bogeyed one of the last two holes since we last checked, but he is still in the lead. 3-shot lead over the guys that are tied for second, Corey Connors, Scottie Scheffler, and Bryson DeChambeau. He is through 16. He's at 4-under. Tyrell Hatton and Ludvig Åberg are at 3-under. You have Harris English, Jason Day at 2-under. I think the big story in the past hour, though, has to do with Rory McIlroy, who just cannot get a win at the Masters. Wants the career Grand Slam, but it keeps avoiding him. He actually today, when he made the turn, he was 3-under. That was it was his best first nine score, the opening round at the Masters since 2011 when he shot a 4-under. But as of lately, he got to 15, had a nice drive, gets around the green, and he chipped one into the water. And right now, Rory McIlroy dropped from 4-under, and he is way, way down. He had a double bogey, and it's not looking good for him at the current moment. I believe he is, let's see here. I'm trying to find it out. Rory McIlroy, yeah, not good. Not good. I think he's 1-over. That's not good. Oh, no, he's even. He's even after having 3-under through the turn. But, man, that guy, I don't know what he needs to do to get over top in the Masters. Usually plays relatively well for the most part, but just always has those blow-up holes and never is able to get there. And like, he had a meeting. This is sort of the story going into the Masters. Was the story going into the Masters. He had a meeting with Jack Nicklaus. They had a lunch meeting. And Jack Nicklaus was trying to impart some wisdom on him. That's what Rory wanted him to do. How did you win the Masters? How did you handle business at Augusta? And Jack Nicklaus says, okay, tell me how you're going to play the course. Take me 1 through 18, how you're going to play the certain holes. Apparently Jack Nicklaus, after their meeting, had nothing to say besides, I wouldn't change a thing about your game plan. And Rory still has his struggles. I don't know what to say about the guy. He wants to get through, get this career Grand Slam. It just evades him in every possible way.
Well, it's golf is one of the more difficult mental sports you have out there. So, yeah, I don't know if Rory has to change anything about his actual game other than you just got to lock in, man. Like, it's as simple as that. Like, we've been waiting for the lock-in moment with Rory in the Masters, and it appears like we might have to wait a little bit longer.
The thing is, it felt so nice for him through about 14 holes. Felt so nice. Then you get to around the 15 green, and here comes a ball that just slopes off directly into the water, and you take your penalty, and you get a double bogey. And considering the guys that are at the top of this leaderboard right now, you're 7 shots off the lead. Scottie Scheffler's playing really well. Bryson DeChambeau's playing really well. It's just, a first round usually does not fully make or break how you're going to play through the weekend.
Right.
But it feels like this is going to make or break. That 15th hole, day one, opening round of the Masters is probably going to break his entire chances of winning this tournament.
There is one of the best Twitter followers you could possibly have or be following during the Masters, and Rory is Jeffrey Wright. I don't know if I've ever met somebody who loves Rory as much as Jeffrey Wright. So, as soon as that ball went in, I was like, oh, no.
That was the first person I thought of. Not Rory McIlroy, not anybody in his team. I thought about Jeffrey Wright immediately.
Yeah, 100%. We never really talked about it, but like, who was your Masters prediction?
I said John Rahm, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Mine was Colin Morikawa.
Yeah, I think that's
which is like not a hot take. It's a lot of people have been picking him.
Yeah. Scottie Scheffler.
Yeah, Jeffrey just tweeted, we should have known better.
But can I be honest with golf in general? Again, I don't think anybody tunes into the Gabe Kuhn show to hear me my golf analysis. But going into any major, how dumb do you feel if you don't pick Scottie Scheffler and he ultimately wins? Right? Like that's the question I have for the golf fanatics.
It's not dissimilar from the conversation about the college basketball NCAA tournament, March Madness. Like, do you go chalk, and do you feel good about yourself if you do pick chalk? Do you get to do a parade? Do you get to take credit for it if you're like, yeah, the best golfer in the world's probably going to win the Masters? And then if they win the Masters, you're like, I told you so.
Exactly. You try to think outside of the box, but ultimately what you know is going to happen in your brain happens. And Scottie Scheffler had a good day. 4 under, didn't even have a single bogey on his card today.
He plays so calm. That's the thing about him. Calm, cool, and collected.
Doesn't get never shaken. And it's just,
even when he gets arrested.
It's true. And I don't even want to call it safe golf, but it's just consistent as hell. He just doesn't make mistakes. Or not even doesn't make mistakes. It doesn't compound mistakes.
Sure.
Rory McIlroy will compound mistakes. We saw it on 15 today. But Scottie Scheffler does not do that. Now, I know how tempting it is to buy that national brand of liquor that you buy every single weekend as you approach the weekend at your local liquor store. But stop doing that. Stop reaching for that national brand. That's hard to break that, but I get it. But we have a local brand that does it better. That's Old Dominic. Go to Old Dominic Distillery. They're right here on the riverfront. 305 South Front Street is where you can find them. They have events all the time. You can check those out at olddominic.com. They have an event space. Go fill out the questionnaire. If you have a corporate dinner or a luncheon you want to get in, if you have a wedding reception you want to have there, go fill out that questionnaire at olddominic.com, and they'll take care of you. But they have so many different bottles of spirits. They have gin, toddy, vodka, bourbon, whiskey. They're always inventing new types of whiskey that they bring to you. They have four separate bottles that you can take advantage of. I would go buy all of them at some point, decide which one you like the most so you can keep it on hand when you're sitting there over the weekend and you have a craving for a drink. But always remember that you can ship Old Dominic Spirits anywhere in the United States of America. Get them as a gift, whether it be the holidays, a birthday, send them around the United States of America. You do that at olddominic.com. And they're the official spirit of the Memphis Grizzlies. So if you get down there tonight, if you're on the way to go watch your Grizzlies against Timberwolves tonight, remember that there's two bar locations inside FedEx Forum by Old Dominic. So whether you're watching the Grizzlies or the Tigers or concert, comedian, whatever it is at FedEx Forum, stop at one of those two bar locations and enjoy a craft cocktail made by my good friends at Old Dominic. Old Dominic Distillery, come say hi. Now we need to go ahead and get into small talk. Make sure that you stay with us. Conway Services, reputable service available 7 days a week. Now, I have a story that revolves around the Masters, but doesn't have to do with actually playing golf. It has to do with somebody who's a credentialed photographer out there. Ken Griffey Jr. joins his former teammate Randy Johnson as a credentialed photographer at multiple sporting events. Ken Griffey Jr. Both of them played on the Seattle Mariners early in their career, both Hall of Famers. I don't know what's in the water in Seattle, but I guess it sort of turns you into like the sourdough bread making, Patagonia wearing photographer. Maybe that's what it is, but I found that pretty cool. Found that pretty cool that Ken Griffey Jr. sort of following in the footsteps of his former teammate and becoming a credentialed photographer at the Masters.
It's got to be awesome to be an all-time great in a sport. Like, Randy Johnson's one of the greatest pitchers we've ever seen. Some people would say Ken Griffey Jr. is the best player we've ever seen. And just to be able to retire and go to the Masters and take photographs, that's the life.
I mean, that's all.
Is there a better life than that?
But, like, you see other guys try to pivot and become businessmen, become sort of, entrepreneurs. You see guys coach. You see guys do all these different things. These guys have chosen to be photographers. And Randy Johnson actually spoke to CBS Sports about this. And apparently he basically said Ken Griffey Jr. called him about trying to get into the business, called him a few times. And initially what got Ken Griffey Jr. into the business is photographing his kids.
Oh, that's
playing
nice.
Playing sports. That's really cool.
That's nice.
That's really cool. But I don't know what it is. Seattle Mariners, you live in the Pacific Northwest for a couple of years.
It's a beautiful area.
Have a camera with you. Take a few nice pictures. I think it changes you to a certain extent. How about that?
Do you think Randy Johnson takes photos of birds?
Absolutely. He strikes me as that.
Do you think he cries when he does it?
Yeah.
That's still one of the most wild things I've ever seen.
That ball was traveling 100 miles per hour. Just nailed that bird. That is still one of the – it really is. I think they did – didn't they do a sports science back on the day on the odds
I believe
of that
so.
Happening? Can you pull that up
I bet
real
I
quick?
Can. I bet I can.
Connor, because I would have to imagine the odds of that, because I've never seen it again. The odds of the timing of that, just astronomical.
Just – all right.
It's got to be in the trillions, right?
No, it's not in the trillions.
Oh, billions?
No, not billions.
Millions.
Millions.
One, I'll just say one in a million. Let's.
One in 13 million.
Okay.
One of the most elite Halloween costumes I've ever seen a couple do. The girl went as a bird.
And the guy went
as a bloody
Randy
bird.
Johnson.
And the guy went as Randy Johnson.
And speaking of sports science, I miss sports science.
I miss it too.
That was awesome. That was great. I loved that.
The SNL parody of sports science is also tremendous, but Jonah Hill.
I haven't seen
it. Do you know what they do?
No.
It's basically what happens when you take a nut shot. It's great.
That hurts.
They just fire tennis balls at him. It's great. Comedy. Comedy.
There are things that are undefeated in comedy, no matter how, you know, mature you think you are.
Dude getting hit in the nuts, always funny.
Getting hit in the nuts, farts. Like, it's just, you can't beat them.
It's funny every time.
Every single time. Now, hour number two has been brought to you, of the Gabe Kuhn Show, has been brought to you by the Memphis Showboats. Get your tickets now to see the Showboats coming up this weekend. They'll be playing the Houston Roughnecks, both teams at 0-2. Really looking for their first win of the season. But you can see them in Simmons Bank Liberty Stadium at 1:30 this Saturday. Just make sure to get tickets, UFL.com, or call 901-341-7008. Again, UFL.com, or call 901-341-7008. Hopefully they can get their first win this weekend, Connor. That's what I'm hoping for. It's been a while. They were the first pick in the UFL draft, and I know Coach Wisenhunt wants to get his first win as the Showboats head coach coming up this weekend. So we'll see if they can make that happen. Now, hour number three is on the way, and we have some football to talk with Kyron Samuels, NFL draft, a little bit of college football.